Good evening. This beautiful spring evening, bright. We often hear in our practice a statement that our life is our practice and our practice is our life. And some outside the practice would say that's just foolishness. You're saying the same thing in different words. Philosophy students might say, it's a tautology. It's just pretentious. Doesn't mean anything. But to us it means a great deal. It's a powerful statement of our practice. And our life does completely encompass our practice, and our practice completely our life. Like one hand washing the other, that kind of intimacy. So let's unpack that a bit. Our life, most of us I think would take our life as our experiences, our emotions, our words, our actions, the thoughts that we have, our encounters with other people and creatures, especially mammals like us, sentient beings, but also inanimate objects. And I'm reminded of a story I heard a long time ago of Suzuki Roshi's widow. Was living at Zen Center after he had died. And she came down to the kitchen one day and she saw these brooms being treated very sloppily. They were just thrown in the corner and haphazardly. She got all over the kitchen crew on that. You know, they need respect. Treat them with respect. Put them away. Take care of them. And it was a powerful lesson. Because the Dharma includes that our practice includes inanimate as well as animate. In fact, our practice doesn't exclude anything. It's pretty powerful in that regard. But our practice is fairly straightforward. It's not complex. It has 4, maybe 5 pillars on the Zen stool that supports the practice. One might be the meditation, walking and sitting, prostrations, chanting, and dokusan. Prostrations places the heart above the head, very important in this practice. Chanting, one sound, one sangha. Dokusan, personal teaching, personal instruction, instead of general discussion, important as well. So it's not difficult to understand what makes up the practice, but the practice isn't necessarily easy. It's not easy to come in and sit without moving for 40 minutes, let alone do it for all day, or let alone do it for a week or even for a month. Not easy at all. So we take it as it comes, and some of us start out maybe with a morning practice, 5 minutes if they can spare that before going off to work, 10 minutes. In the evening, the same. You balance that morning and evening is a good way to go to prepare ourselves for the day's activities and the night activities, including sleep. We find that a lot in the Eastern spiritual practices and other areas, this dyad, yin yang, and the Lao Tzu, and we see that a lot. Nirvana Samsara, this is a dyad that works a lot in the practice. So morning and evening sitting is a good way to do that. It gives us balance through the day. And balance is a real important part of this practice. And it's not talked about much. But we do a fair amount of balancing when you get right down to it. We sit on a cushion and we get out of alignment very easily. And sometimes we can get pretty far out of alignment when we bring ourselves back. But as we breathe, we're getting ourselves out of alignment, just microscopically. So it's a continual awareness and readjustment of our breathing and our posture. The breathing, is it a shallow breath or a deep breath? We'd like to have nice deep breaths into the hara. That's where we place our attention, not on our head, but in the hara. And the Eastern peoples, in this practice especially, considers that the center of our being. So it's good to ground ourselves on the ground and ground ourselves in our body with our breath. So we balance the breath. Sometimes we find ourselves with shallow breath, and that produces a lot of thinking and other stuff, saliva and whatnot. So there's balance right through the whole practice, even balance on the precepts. The precepts are our North Star. We don't necessarily go straight ahead to the North Star. We might take quite a few circumnavigate around and learn our way, but we know where the North Star is. But even the precepts have to be balanced and not taken as perfectionistic. It's very difficult to keep the precepts on a perfectionistic basis. Do not kill, and we take one step and we destroyed, I don't know how many microbes and things like that. So we have to be a bit loose on some of those things. Intention, I think, helps a lot. If our intentions are good and benevolent, then that's the best we can do. We do the best we can as often as we can for as many as we can, and just leave it alone after that. This is never a perfectionistic practice. But the practice includes everything. There's nothing excluded. And I guess the basic teaching is non-separation. And when you bring that teaching in, the practice really expands. If we're not separate from anything else, then we've got a big practice here. We're sitting with everything. And manifesting everything in our sitting. It's a being practice, not a doing practice. But the non-separation has many, many aspects to it. Cohen illustrated this one time at Jikoji by two sentences. He said, just out of the blue, he wasn't talking about this at all, but he just said, no gap between creator and created. That got attention. And then he followed that up. He looked us in the eye and says, you are not creator. And that says a lot about the practice. It's not two. There's no gap between you and creator. It's not two. And you are not creator. It's not one either. So what is it? What's mysterious? And it's beyond our human grasp. And we humans may not like that. We like to think we're going to Mars and Moon and we can do anything. But this practice is really beyond our human capacities to understand and comprehend. And that's a good thing. Because it doesn't leave anything out, whether we can understand it or not. It's in the principle of non-separation. The precepts are an important part of the practice, and they're best dealt with not by taking it as we would normally in the West, of prioritizing and saying what's the most important one for me and I'll work on that, I'll go down the list. No, the precepts came out of our practice many, many centuries ago, the early Sangha. They were having difficulties and they got together and talked it over and decided to try this and try that, and they came up with the precepts. And the best way to deal with the precepts is sit with them and let the precepts work on us. We take those vows and they work on us slowly, like a noose. You squeeze it out and you'll see, wow, I didn't do anything to practice it. So it's an interesting process, this practice. Some of it's conscious and some of it isn't conscious. But it's here and it works. Yeah, it's a very powerful practice. The non-separation also is the basis for all the vows we take. Bodhisattva vow, non-separation, we're working on ourselves, right? We're showing compassion for ourselves when we act in a bodhisattva manner. Same with the precepts. We're not going to steal from ourselves. We're not going to abuse ourselves. So the non-separation is a very powerful part of the practice. And that's what we're sitting with, non-separation. A non-separation. One hand, two hands. Gotcha. Does anybody have any questions? Yes.
If we're one with our practice, totally. I do our practice. Then how can we become separate from
it? You can't become separate. The separation is the practice, is the essence. We don't do anything. We're already connected integrally from beginning this time. We can't get separate. We live in this ego world in a separate manner, but it's an illusion. It's a complete illusion. It's a real illusion. But an illusion. And Shakyamuni had two examples of this in the sutras. One was dreams. Somebody's chasing you, you've got a nightmare going, and somebody's chasing you with a weapon. And he or she's getting closer. And you're perspiring, you're running. You got a charley horse in your leg. All of a sudden, poof, you wake up. And you realize, oh, it's a dream. And I thought it was real. But it was real. You're lying in bed in a pool of perspiration. You've got a jolly horse. It's a lived bodily experience. It's real. It was a dream. It didn't occur in this ego world that we live in. It occurred in the dream space, which is the fourth level of reality for the Tibetans. But it's not this reality. So it's an illusion. And the other example he gave was of a rainbow. Let's say you're out walking with some friends and you see a rainbow over yonder and decide to walk over to it. You get over there and there's no rainbow. It was an optical illusion. It's an illusion, but you registered that with your senses, your optic nerve, you saw it. So it registered in your body, it was real. It's illusionary and real. And that's that's really what we have in this life that we live. There's no substance there. If you go into your skin, you find epidermal layers and organic rings and atoms in the rings. And you crack an atom up, and there's more rings, and you crack that, more rings, more atoms. As far down as you go, you'll find rings and atoms. That's it. Same going out. We went to the moon in 1969 and brought back samples to Cal Berkeley and to Caltech, and they tested them. The same thing there. Rings and atoms, there's nothing there. So we live in a sea of emptiness. This practice is empty. The Dharma is empty. This practice is insubstantial, this ego world. But the Dharma world is substantial. It's substantial. The Dharma is substantial. We're not nihilists, and this is not a nihilistic practice. It's a substantial practice. Very much worthwhile pursuing. The Dharma, light, and compassion is our very essence. And we get that shine out when we sit on the Zafu, we walk in it, or anything. It's our very essence. We're working with that, and I guess taming body and mind to let that show through more easily, our true essence, our true self.